You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, Episode 11. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we are going to be interviewing archaeologist David Givens, the senior archaeologist at Historic Jamestown.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. We've got a pretty exciting show today. We've got Mr. David Givens on the line from Historic Jamestown. I met David at the Society for Historical Archaeology meetings this year in Dallas, Texas. And had a really good conversation about Jamestown, and I wanted to get him on the show, and now we finally have it. David, how's it going?
It's good. Good. Good to be on the show, guys.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Well, before we get to talking about Jamestown, why don't you introduce yourself and give a little bit of background and what you do at Jamestown?
Yeah, I'm Dave Givens, one of the senior archaeologists at the Jamestown Rediscovery Program, and I've been there since 2001, involved in various capacities over the years. I was trained as a prehistorian up in the mountains near Virginia Tech and ended up going to Virginia Commonwealth University and getting into colonial studies, and eventually worked my way down to Jamestown in the area and been stuck there ever since.
All right. Well, before we talk about Jamestown too much, let's find out what it is, just in case people haven't heard about it. I mean, I'm on the West Coast, and I'll be honest, I probably didn't know a whole lot about Jamestown until I lived on the East Coast for a long time and actually worked up in Virginia for a little while and heard about it that way, which is a really sad statement about our education system, which doesn't sound like it's getting any better. But that's another conversation. But why don't you give us a little bit of a quick history of Jamestown, what it is, and why Jamestown is important?
So, Jamestown was founded in 1607. It was a for-profit corporate venture, our nation's first corporate venture, by the Virginia Company. And it was the outgrowth of business and capitalist ventures of England at the time, just following suit in the Muscovy Company or the Dutch East India Company, for example. And the colonists came over. They left in 1606 and actually arrived in 1607, set up a fortification there, and then expanded out across the landscape in the subsuming century. And then the town was moved. The fort grew into a town and then a city. Jamestown was moved to what today is Colonial Williamsburg in 1699. And it amalgamated into single landholders and farms by the Civil War. And then was a portion of it purchased by the folks I work for in 1893. And then the Park Service joined us in the 1930s.
Okay.
And that's a short history of where we are today.
Awesome. Awesome. And Williamsburg, how far away is that? Just geographically?
It's not very far. It's, it's not walking distance, but, depending on where you define Williamsburg or downtown Colonial Williamsburg, it's, say 10 miles or so.
Okay. Yeah. I actually didn't know they were that close to each other. Is there a town of Jamestown now, or is it the park and the archaeological site?
No, when visitors come out or you come out to Jamestown, there's nothing to see extant except for the church tower and the Ambler ruins. The Ambler family had a plantation out there. Plantation was burned in 1865, and it's a lost landscape. And that's been somewhat of the drive for archaeology, is to sort of paint that landscape back into the American narrative, as it were. And that includes English, indigenous interaction, and then first Africans in 1619.
Okay. And again, before we dive deeper into Jamestown, just kind of get the setting down. Another thing people may have heard of that I believe is associated with Jamestown in a way is the Lost Colony of Roanoke. That's not too far away. Am I right on that?
No. Again, not,
not at all.
As the crow flies, it's just down in the Carolina Sound, not more than a couple hours from Jamestown.
Okay. It didn't have anything to do with the same people that settled Jamestown. I kind of thought it did, but I guess not.
Well, tangentially, the Virginia mm-hmm. Company had taken quite a few cues from the intertribal actions by the English down there. There was a dictionary of Algonquian words that was brought to Jamestown. So, it's quite a mm-hmm. bit of learning there by the English.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the archaeology at Jamestown. It's interesting being in such a, I was kind of talking to you a little bit about this in Dallas, but, it's interesting to me that you're in a single area, you know, as archaeologists, like a CRM archaeologist like myself, you know, all over the place, you're working in a different place all the time, but just working at Jamestown, how big of a job is that? How big of an area are we talking about here? And not only that, but what kind of methodology are you guys using? Are you just systematically excavating the entire area? And, you know, how long will that take?
Well, the first part of your question is that it's about an acre and a half to 2 acres, a focus on the fortification there, which is 1607 to 24. Mm-hmm. We are expanding out with our partners, the Park Service, starting hopefully in April. And we'll be looking at the site of one of the first Africans that arrived in 1620 mm-hmm. For our anniversary coming up here in a couple of years. So it varies, but not more than sort of smaller site zones. Mm-hmm. We do follow in the footsteps of some pretty amazing historical archaeologists, Pinky Harrington, John Cotter, H. Summerfield Day before him. So we have a long history of archaeology in the past century. And thankfully, they were excellent field archaeologists and kept great notes and records. And we use the same grid system that was established in 1934.
Is 1934 when the first excavations were done at Jamestown?
Yes, okay. Formal excavations. Park Service, once they acquired the property, immediately began looking at the resources out there, and under the Civilian Conservation Corps Act had the CCC working on site. They did a fair amount of excavations of what we call New Town. So Old Town, New Town.
Okay.
Pretty substantial. And our colleagues are really amazed often when they start understanding the history of archaeology, historical archaeology on the site. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So with excavations going back to the 1930s, do you ever consider or do you ever go back and kind of relook at some of these areas that were excavated early on or reanalyze some of the data that came from these early excavations?
Yeah, in fact, we're involved with that right now because we're starting, again, a collaborative effort with the Park Service to look at one of the sites attributed to the first Africans out in what's called Newtown. East of the fort, and it's the requirements with the collaborative effort are to research the previous archives, look at current digital assets with LIDAR and ground penetrating radar and things that we can do together to get a good picture. And so it's been, for me, this is very apropos to ask that question because I've been waist deep in old maps and profiles and pictures, and it's just completely fascinating, really.
I was gonna say that's one of the things that we were talking to you guys about it in Dallas was the wealth of information you have collected there already from the decades of work that's been done there. That's quite the job managing that, isn't it?
It is. I think we're uniquely positioned in a sense of having all these assets And as we talked about in Dallas, that they present problems of scope for archiving and managing. And I think they're, for us, it's these problems of huge volumes of data and different assets that have been accumulated over time are a challenge for us, and we've always taken them on even before this project with the park.
You know, I got to comment on that real quick. You keep mentioning your partnership with the Park Service. Is this not a how does that work? Is this not a national park, so to speak? There's just a what's the partnership aspect of it?
Yeah, so Preservation Virginia, the folks I work for, which were formerly known as the Association for Preservation of Virginia Antiquities, they acquired 22 acres within inside the island in 1893, and the park joined us in just after the start of the Depression in the 30s. So yeah, it's always been a collaborative effort. The archaeology has been on two sides of the line, if you will. And the APVA had started archaeology. Actually, one of the first women archaeologists in historical archaeology, Mary Jeffrey Galt, and some of her other compatriots from Williamsburg, were doing excavations in the 1890s up to the restoration of the memorial church we have out there up to 1906. And we're, as part of the 2019 celebrations of the democracy, we're also looking at that memorial church and those excavations.
Okay. So Jamestown, it's not federally recognized as a national park, or what kind of federal standing does it have?
It is.
It is? Okay.
Yeah, it's on the National Register.
Okay, gotcha. Just trying to kind of wrap my head around that. So with the archaeology, how deep are you guys going? Are you focused? Is it go back to the settlement of Jamestown, or do you guys just keep on going as long as you have material into prehistoric stuff?
No, it's a rather uniquely positioned site. It in the prehistoric material, and I hate to use those terms because, as we found, that tends to be a bit reductionist to talk about prehistory and history.
That's true.
We see it more as a continuum. And in the context of that continuum, things, the narrative tends to change. But we have thousands of years of occupation of the island. And then one of the, ironically, one of the richest contact period sites in the state of Virginia, they're at the fort. And then, of course, the arrival of first Africans and the implications that means for the archaeology, which we're about to address. So, very exciting place for the American public in our history.
So you keep using the term contact period. And just for some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with kind of our archaeology slang, would you just kind of explain what that means and contextualize it in terms of the history of Jamestown for us?
Yeah. In fact, I don't even like to use the word contact just because the Algonquians in our area certainly had you know, that's a hazy term. It's slippery because, as one of the colonists pointed out in his journal, there were blonde-haired kids running through the woods with the Indians. And the Lost Colony, of course, those folks had probably disappeared and amalgamated into local populations. And so we tend, for the general public, we say the word contact, but it's something that we've sort of shied away from with our studies. But when the English settle in the New World, they position themselves within the Powhatan polity or chiefdom, which is as many as 15,000 Algonquians strong. And we think that's an intentional act by the Virginia Company so that they could have food and other things and explore. And that becomes the central sort of theme throughout those first few years, is the power, sort of interstitial ideas of the Powhatan and the English upon each other. And that space between 1607 and 10 is a very unique and localized and for us a non-generalized view of the past.
What was the relationship like with the Native Americans? I mean, obviously, very tense early on. I know they had some relationships, like you were mentioning, with you know, trade and supplies, and the Native Americans were helping them out. But as we know, most relationships early on in that time frame went, it probably descended from there. You know, what was it like moving past that initial period?
Yeah, we have a really unique situation in which, of course, we've got the historic documents, the historic records. And it's clear that agents like John Smith and William Strachey and others are acting on their own volition, as are the indigenous population. So, for example, when the English first arrive, the Nansemonds and other groups within the polity are acting independently, but then are sort of reined in, as are the English, and what both organizations are looking at trying to straighten out the formal relations and dominate one each other. And so what ends up happening is that as individuals commit violence, that sort of begets violence, and the English are chiefly interested in incorporating the population, as are the indigenous. The natives wish to make, for example, John Smith Powhatan's son. Powhatan says that. Mm-hmm. And John Smith says, "I have another father, and his name's King James." And so there's this for us, this wonderful interplay between the agents and their aims and goals in a broader sort of Atlantic world sense. So
I'm sure there isn't a massive Native American presence there now, obviously, like there was before. So when did the balance of power in that era start to shift in that region?
Well, as tobacco became a chief commodity of export in the New World, the colonists slowly spread out on the landscape and pushed the Virginia Indians to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. And
yeah,
we still have the one of the oldest reservations in the United States, the Pamunkey Indian Reservation. And the Pamunkey, there are colleagues, there are archaeologists, Pamunkey archaeologists, and they're still here.
Awesome. All right. Well, we've got a lot more questions for you, and we'll get into some more history of Jamestown and some of the archaeology you guys are doing, and then maybe some of the technology you're employing and will employ there later. But that'll be in future segments. We'll be back in just a minute.
Let's face it, the quality of archaeological field photography could really use some improvement. We aim to change this with the Codify Magic Photo Board. This lightweight but incredibly durable board is designed to help you take color-perfect photos of artifacts, features, and sites using almost any camera, even your smartphone. You need to see it to believe it. Engineered from exceptional quality, color-safe, high-pressure laminate, Codify Magic Photo Board is ready for tough field conditions. It's guaranteed to level up your photography. Start taking publication-worthy photos right in the field with the Codify Magic Photo Board. Available now for pre-order, visit codify.com/APN. That's codify.com/APN today, and get your promo code exclusively for listeners of the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Okay, we're back. And so, David, there's a podcast that I've been kind of mulling over in my head that I want to do. Kind of like a Unsolved Mysteries kind of podcast, where, you know, we try to find questions that somebody had about an era or a time frame or a site or something like that that were specifically answered by doing the archaeology. Now, whenever I ask somebody what questions, you know, have you had any questions that were answered by archaeology? They almost always say yes, because archaeology inherently answers questions you didn't even know you were going to ask. So, you know, the minute you pull something out of the ground, you're like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. But did you guys, in your long tenure there at Jamestown, have you had any research questions that you're like, man, I wonder what happened here or with this or with that? And then either an intentional excavation or just subsequent excavations happen to turn up information that answered that question. Can you think of anything that sticks out in your head?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the entire project has been a 22, 23-year history, answering questions and, of course, bringing new ones to the table. of both the history of Jamestown, but also historical archaeology. And one of the first ones was, where did the fort go? For centuries, people thought the fort was washed away in the James River due to erosion. And Dr. Kelso, our director of archaeology, began digging between the James River and the Memorial Church, thinking that maybe he might find a handful of artifacts to celebrate the America's 400th anniversary in 2007. And the way we dig is like a giant game of Battleship. You just dig one square after another. And serendipitously, he probably hate me saying that, but serendipitously, he came down on one of the earliest features in the history of the project, Pit 1, a pit for mining clay for the sides of their buildings. And for 22 years, we've been just digging one square after the other, following the history where it takes us. And so we found the fort. We wanted to know what kind of buildings, and we have, you know, very sort of gray descriptions of the houses and the layout of the fort. And the past 22 years have illuminated that in a sense that we can finally sort of colorize that onto maps and things.
Did you guys find all the margins of the fort? Like, I assume it was like a square-ish, you know, fortification with buildings inside of it. That's just kind of my assumption. Was any of it washed into the James River, or do you guys actually find all of it?
Yeah, it's actually, oddly enough, it's a triangle.
Oh.
And that's mentioned even today in military teachings about having a fortification on a ridge line. They suggest a triangle so that you have overlapping fields of fire. And so they employed a triangle on the landform, and then we have lost about 13-15% of the original 1607 fort, but we can project those lines and understand its original shape. The fort did expand to five sides in 1608, not really a pentagon, but it is five sided. And then the town grew very quickly from there.
Okay. And the town was outside the fortifications, I assume?
Yes. Yes, yeah. It grew eastward out of the fort. And John Smith mentions 30 or 40 houses. We've only found seven main houses, which is somewhat confusing. so the point there is there'll be generations of archaeology answer some of these questions about the growth from the fort to town to the city.
Yeah. Well, what was the, what was the maximum population of Jamestown before it kind of all turned into farmland?
Well, the city that was there, several, you know, 100 people probably at maximum. It was a thriving port town. Previous archaeology has shown, you know, they sort of have the ceramics of England and all over the world arriving in that port town. That's sort of the artwork that's shown. But it was having representative government there in 1619. It was the focal point because, you know, everything had to flow into Jamestown to go out of the colonies. So the Cape merchant was there, and tobacco check stations, way stations were there. And that's, you know, of course, that was all there till it was removed in 1699.
What percentage, what percentage of the total site area would you say has been fully excavated, like with block excavation?
Well, the fort, the original fort site, which has taken us 22 years to dig, is about an acre and a half, and that's still not finished completely. The expansion, we've probably done 1% of that, of the 08, and then so 22 years to do an acre and a half ish and there's 60 acres of the city, so quite a bit to be found.
And you guys doing usual, you know, archaeological survey methods on that, like with shovel testing and then probably some non-destructive stuff? I think you mentioned GPR and LIDAR and things like that.
We do. For the dig site, the fort site area, it's been just one expanding grid system squares. So we don't need LIDAR. We have done ground penetrating radar three times, but it's really to work with the folks that are out there to sort of hone their methods.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, so we're going to go dig whatever they saw and give them confirmation. So we've worked with principally Bruce Bevan, Dr. Bruce Bevan, over the years to look at different non-invasive geophysical techniques as he's developing his toolkit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now this New Angeles site, though, that's a whole new gig. Quite a bit of the area where this woman, Angela, this Angolan, was mm-hmm. living, has not been excavated. That mm-hmm. I should say the home lot of this Captain William Pierce has not been excavated to a large degree, a full extent. And so we have started with ground penetrating radar, mm-hmm. And we'll do things like chemical testing and phytolith and all kinds of. Don't know if we'll do shovel testing, but mm-hmm. that's certainly a possibility.
Okay, how deep are the? Just curious from an archaeological standpoint, how deep are the earliest deposits out there? Because I know that part of the coast gets a lot of sand deposited on it. Just like one storm can drop a lot of material there.
Yeah, you know, thankfully. And I've in my previous life in CRM, I've worked in floodplains that material mm-hmm. is 3 meters deep. You know, you're looking at 9 feet. It's kind of scary being down that deep. But where we are, sort of up on the hill where the fort was, and when I say hill, our sea level heights don't exceed 14 feet, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's only about mm-hmm. 18 to 24 inches below at maximum. Oh. Yeah, so it's pretty easy. There are some middens out near the river that start to get to about 6 to 8 feet deep. And it's, mm-hmm. so that's something we've had to deal with in the past. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of staff are you using to get all this archaeology done? And, you know, do you take volunteers and kind of people who are just interested in getting involved in sort of early American history?
So the sensitivity of Jamestown requires that folks have a training with our methods. And so we require most folks to have taken our field school. So we have a summer institute through the University of Virginia every year. And then I would say, 80% of our staff are the result of that. So we do the field school, then we have intern funding for them to continue. We work with our students as they go through their specific graduate programs and have them use Jamestown as a topic. But that's, mm-hmm. We do work with specialists, and we have had guest archaeologists from the Netherlands and England and our colleagues from the Lost Colony. But yeah, it's a very, you know, the public sees us out there and they think we're just dusting about dirt. But as you guys know, it's often a very serious venture when you're trying to define America's beginnings.
Yeah.
In the context of finding things like evidence of cannibalism and working with human remains that are untold stories, folks didn't make it into the historic documents. That's a pretty serious thing that's leveled at us, or we level it ourselves in order to mm-hmm. humanize that past and make it a tangible change for our visitors. In other words, when they come out, they may think John Smith married Pocahontas, or they just saw the Disney movie of Pocahontas. And I feel that they leave our dig and our museum, which is an archaeological museum, with a changed and often shared past, an understanding that it's not the same old story or narrative you've heard of the American past, but one that is actually very engaging and positions people to say, hey, you know, that's an amazing story. And it's a unifying story in a way, because you do see people often see themselves in those positions, like, what would I have done in the hardest of times, right? Mm-hmm. So we take it pretty seriously, and require our coworkers and our students to do so as well.
Yeah, that's a massive responsibility. And it's encouraging to hear that, you know, you guys are, it's definitely first on your mind when you're working out there. That leads us, that's kind of a good segue into my next question. What about descendant communities in the area, both colonists and Native Americans? Are there people in the area that you work with that are descended from these people that of that time frame?
Yeah, so that's a fairly broad base of the population for the English. Yeah, and there are English descendants. Everybody comes out, and I'm digging out there in the hot sun, and they, you know, they announce that they're related to, such and so colonists, and do I know them? And I don't know. Every person that came through what is, you know, America's Ellis Island there. Yeah. But, we work with the Pamunkey Indian tribe. They, a number of years ago in the anniversary of the marriage of John Rolfe and Pocahontas, we wanted to address Pocahontas in our museum. And it was a hard task to look at her, and because our everything in our museum is represented by artifacts, and we know nothing really of Pocahontas except through the historic documents, which are often wrong, or sort of whitewash an indigenous woman of the past. And so we worked, like I said, we have one of the richest contact period sites, and that story wasn't necessarily being told to the degree that we felt as a staff needed to be told. And so we worked with the Pamunkey to have a non-Eurocentric perspective of an English fort, which is rather unique. But it's a story that we had to tell.
So, kind of bridging, going off of this, can you talk a little bit more about how you really work to blend the archaeological research and data that you're getting into this public interpretation? Because I know you guys get a ton of visitors, and you're kind of loosely affiliated or affiliated with Colonial Williamsburg in that kind of Virginia tourist circuit. Yeah. So it'd be really interesting to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I mean, for us, if you want to make a substantive change, you need to have those eyeballs, right? Looking at your exhibits and your books and things like that. So it comes down to, you're exactly right, a regional sense. And so we work with the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, the Jamestown Settlement, which is a first-person theme park next door to Jamestown, the Park Service, and other local organizations to try and create, you know, a visitor-friendly environment that allows people to essentially start with the alpha that is Jamestown and the omega that is Yorktown. Of American, our American beginnings, from Jamestown to the Revolution down in Yorktown. So, yeah, it's always been sort of chief on the minds of the folks specifically to Jamestown. Mm-hmm. Within the context of Jamestown, we work with students and publish books for our visitors that are honestly not super text heavy. We have found that folks really enjoy seeing the pictures of archaeology, right? 150 words, very challenging. It's actually painful to fit a story in it. But we found that it's actually allowing people to take the exhibit home with them, and then we can elaborate on some of the ideas in the exhibit. So it's a sort of an exhibit to page. And then, of course, we go out and give lectures, podcasts like today. And next week, I'm headed to the next week,
nice.
Week after next, to the British Library with the Pamunkey to talk about the World of Pocahontas Unearthed, which is the name of our exhibit, and talk about some of the challenges of putting on an exhibit like that and making a difference to changing the narrative of our past and educating the American public.
It's really interesting. So you mentioned the Jamestown Settlement, where its kind of costume interpretation and a little bit of a reconstruction of what the community may have looked like. So how have, I have a secret history as a costumed interpretive, historic interpreter, at a park fairly similar. And so how do you really work to blend and bring in the new information and interpretations that are coming from the archaeology into this kind of either first or third person interpretation that's happening in the park, and kind of connect those narratives and kind of experience the visitors are going to have?
Well, there's certainly a dichotomy there. Jamestown is the real place. You're gonna see the real things and the real people that were there in our museum, and then you're gonna talk to the real folks that excavated those. That's in the, you know, during the season, that's 7 days a week. The settlement has always been first person education on a sense that they have a recreated Indian village in the fort. And that's a needed place. But the two organizations haven't really synchronized in the past, and we're working towards correcting that. And it's hard because each player in the historic triangle, Yorktown, Colonial Williamsburg, and Jamestown, have a say and they want a piece of that. But you can't, you know, you can't take away the real things and the real people and the real history, which is what we are. And that's what we always hang our hat on. And we'll always stick to that.
It's great.
Nice. Well, that's a good point to take a pause and go to break. And we'll come back for our last segment in just a minute. The Archaeotech Podcast, hosted by Chris Webby Webster and Chris Boone Sims, is a show dedicated to the technology of the modern archaeologist. On the Archaeotech Podcast, we interview people using interesting tech, and we dig into the issues, advantages, and try to uncover the disadvantages of the digital age and going paperless. We all know there is no paper in the future, or should we say, paper has no future. Check out the show at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeotech. Let's get back to the show. Okay, we're back, and this is our last segment, and just to, everything we've talked about so far, we could really dive into for an extended period of time. But just to give people an overview of the archaeology that's going on at Jamestown and what's happening there, I want to dive into a little bit of some of your methods and technologies and things that are coming up. And by the way, if there's anything we've mentioned, any links, I mean, definitely the Jamestown website will be linked in the show notes for this. So check that out. And if there's anything else we can think of or David sends us between now and when the show posts, then we'll have that there too. So if you're listening to this, definitely check out the show notes. But I want to get into, some of the technology you either may be employing now. You've already mentioned a little bit of it, but some of the stuff you might be employing in the future. One thing we kind of just brushed on when we were having a conversation in Dallas was something that's all the rage and was in Dallas, which is virtual reality. Are you guys, is that on your roadmap, your near-term roadmap for not just archaeologists and visualization from a work and methodology standpoint, but for tourists as well and people that maybe can't visit Jamestown? What's your guys' current stance on virtual reality and collecting data in order to present it in that way?
Yeah, so in a general sense, technology for us has to be a useful tool on a daily basis. In other words, oftentimes our lives out there, it's like a mash unit, mm-hmm. and it's got to work. And we hone our tools pretty quickly, pretty easily. And if it fits in our toolkit, we grab it. If not, for example, GPR, love it, would love to use it every day, can't afford it. And of course, the second we buy that machine, it's out of date.
Yeah.
And so what we have found is to collaborate with organizations, universities, and then we're finding that's a much richer environment for both education, on-site, moving forward with our toolkit and getting things figured out. So you mentioned virtual reality. That's the case with our local university, William & Mary. Mm-hmm. A number of the staff are developing a VR STEM based program based on the evidence of a cannibalized woman we found. And so off-site or VR environment folks will be able to explore the archaeology and come to understand how and why the starving time, the event happened in the winter of 69 and 10, and then ultimately see the archaeologists excavating. They would be able to excavate themselves away and explore the evidence for themselves, which is, of course, chief to the STEM experience is that there's, you know, there's always a Dr. Kelso, but there's 100 people behind him that are making that happen. And so, you know, we're trying to position the VR stuff within that. So we're into that. We've had Google come out and scan. Our museum and some of the other site, which folks can see up online, I think. And we of course do a lot of scanning ourselves. But yeah, it's in general, it's a technology. It's got to work for us and got to be quick and dirty, quick and simple.
Yeah,
and does the job.
Well, I imagine for a lot of virtual reality, I mean, the archaeology will actually. Will obviously help define where things happened and the layouts of things. But for someone to eventually, you know, sometime in the future, be able to walk through historic Jamestown at various periods of time, you really have to go to the historical records. How are those early records in describing or even drawings or whatever, you know, what the early buildings and fortifications and stuff actually looked like? Do you have actual drawings of that stuff, or is it just textual representations, people talking about it? What are the records like?
Yeah, they're rich, but the example Dr. Kelso often gives of the historic record is in football, you have four, you know, referees standing there looking at the play and they still have to go to monitor, to make a decision. And we're trying to look back on a play that's 400 years old, and it's difficult. So, for example, the colonists described the fort as planks and strong posts. So the fort had always been interpreted as, pickets or planks, like you'd buy it at Lowe's or Home Depot, like right outside the store. And that wasn't the case. It was split rails that were put in a trench in the ground and then tied together at the top. And when we did experimental archaeology and started splitting these posts, we figured, this is really easy. I mean, it's not easy, but it's much quicker than sawing every plank, right? And so, when they said they built their fort very, very quickly, 19 days or so, then that became sort of an understanding for us. And that's one of many, many, many descriptions to the fort that we've got it. It's, you know, like the storehouse is 120 feet long in three parts. And it turns out it is. It's a one part dry storage, one part cooler and well, and one part bread ovens, all tied together in an L shape. But it doesn't say L shape, it just says three parts. And until we found it, we didn't quite understand. So yeah, the archaeology certainly illuminates the past in both sort of broad contextual senses, but also in very discreet, as we've talked about earlier in the podcast.
So you mentioned doing some experimental archaeology for kind of figuring out how the fort itself was built. Have you done other experimental projects to kind of clarify both the descriptions that you're finding and the archaeological evidence and kind of reconcile those two?
We have. We've done everything from creating mud walls, as the colonists described. We have blacksmiths from Colonial Williamsburg have made items. We've actually made iron on site from local material, and then out of those made nails. We have reconstructed one of the buildings as a frame, which you mentioned earlier, you can see on our website. And also, let me mention that we also have a YouTube channel. Just type in Jamestown Rediscovery, and you can get sort of an inside perspective on a lot of these things I'm talking about. But we've worked with a brick yard guys over at Colonial Williamsburg. So it's been a very varied experimental archaeology program. And you really, honestly, you really have to do that to get in the, you know, what Jim Dietz said, the mindset of a 17th century person. And it's been a fascinating interplay between the documents, the archaeology, and a local understanding of what that is for the staff. Yeah.
Can you think of other examples? Like I'm fascinated by stuff like the planks, like their description of that. And then you go find that, you know, it's something different, but that's language, right? Language changes over the course of 400 years. And we come to, is that the case? Can you think of any other cases where, you know, some of the historical documents are describing something and then maybe the definitions that have changed? Or is it really just simply the case of, like, you know, if I were to explain car repair to somebody not knowing anything about what I'm talking about, I'd use all the wrong words. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's how long do we have on this podcast? Yeah, it's like, okay, so one of the most elegant examples, I think, was we found two structures parallel to the west northwestern fort wall mm-hmm. of the triangle. You know, 90 feet long, and then the other one was a bit shorter, but there were cobblestone foundations that on top would have had timber frame buildings. Mm-hmm. Now, the description of the early fort, actually 1614 of the fort by Ralph Hamer, colonist Ralph Hamer, he says, in the fort there are two fair rows of houses, two stories with a corn loft, all of framed timber, meaning basically two and a half stories. A corn loft is a half story, so... Mm-hmm. We only found two houses, and historians and archaeologists, without having seen that evidence in the past, architecture historians had painted a picture of the fort with two rows of houses. Hmm. And as we looked at what we found in the ground and the documents, it says two fair rows of houses, and a light bulb went off. And what the colonist Ralph Hamer saying is two fair row houses.
Ah.
They're fair row houses, and just, you know, like brownstones in Baltimore. And that's what we've got. And so until we found the archaeology, we weren't able to sort of understand what the gentleman was saying. And, mm-hmm. you know, that may seem somewhat benign, but it's a big deal when you're trying to create in the future a virtual environment like we talked about. What did that house look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how long was it? Where was the fireplaces? All these things, when you begin to model them, start to be problematic unless you know the details. So.
Yeah. What's the extent of the literature from that first few years? Did everyone keep journals, and you guys got your hands on them? I mean, how much is there from that first few years?
It's voluminous. Smith wrote quite a bit. William Strachey, who was shipwrecked on Bermuda with all the incoming folks like Governor Gates and John Rolfe and Reverend Buck, he kept pretty decent. So, you know, there's a huge amount of early information, but again, it's often very gray.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're trying to talk about the past, it's got to be more than just that. And honestly, for the past 400 years, there's been some gross generalities that have been, implemented out of those, because there was a large move to push forward an American understanding of our past. In other words, Jamestown was superimposed by Plymouth. In a sense, as being the, you know, the American Genesis story. Yeah, they're rich, but you've got to have the archaeology to tell the story.
Right.
So one of the things that I've encountered talking to other historic archaeologists who have this sort of extensive documentary evidence is that we use this to kind of build these narratives that become the truth because they're built on historic documents. How often at Jamestown have you found through the archaeology opportunities to sort of challenge these dominant narratives where you find things that don't necessarily contradict what we know, but kind of circumvent or allow us to ask other questions that might, you know, that help our change our understandings?
Yeah, I mean, the first sort of myth that we debunked was that the colonists were lazy and dumb and were bowling in the streets. That's certainly, there probably weren't people that were working to their full abilities, as John Smith said, but we found a very diverse group of the population, actually European population, that are engaged in various tasks, goldsmithing, glass making, timber framing, things like that, creating iron. And so that was one of the first sort of ideas that the project had debunked, and showing the variety of individuals or agents within that sort of gross generalized past. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the most recent one was the engagement of the Virginia Indian material into the narrative, which positioned the story of particularly the Pamunkey within a very narrow time frame, and gave agency to them, you know, arguably having one of the first Thanksgivings at Jamestown in the winter of 1608-9, when they fed the colonists. We've got 40 some thousand sherds of ceramics from that 1 year of food being brought where the Powhatan wanted the English to survive. Mm-hmm. And so I think for us, that, you know, stories like that are examples of what archaeology can do for you. And it's not just, sort of passing stories. Those make a difference when you're able to educate with that and show it through artifacts. That's the key, right? So we're not just talking about anthropological concepts. You're seeing, people can see a pipe maker that came from England and threw out his entire pipe making kit, which he'd had his entire life in London, to make pipes like a Virginia Indian, and stamp names on those pipes like Sir Walter Raleigh and other Virginia Company officials and things for export. And that's just, those aren't in the historic document.
That reminds me, I can't believe I kind of glossed over this in the beginning, but you mentioned this being one of the first, well, the first corporate town, really, because it was the Virginia Company that that brought the first people over. What was their job? Like, what were they, like you mentioned, you know, people saying they were lazy. You guys are proving that's not true, but they must have had some kind of skill set, those first people that came over, because what was the company's, like, what was the mission of the company when they got here? What were they trying to do?
Yeah, it was various, from finding the lost colonists is one of the tasks John Smith was charged with, to finding gold. And so that's where, the indigenous population becomes critical. The Virginia Company aims is conducting interviews in their language, which is pretty amazing, about where copper, silver, and gold were coming from. Okay. And I mentioned copper and silver because they're often found in conjunction in the same kind of geology that gold is found. So we know that those questions and the explorations were going on, and the number of the colonists meet their demise by being involved in these ventures exploring into the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. That's God, that's so interesting. Because I mean, it sounds like it was more of a fact finding mission than an exploratory mission. But was the Virginia Company set up to do this in the Americas? They're like, hey, look at this whole new continent. Let's form a company to go figure out what's going on and just do it from a business standpoint. Or was this an older company in England and they did this around the world or something like that, or just an offshoot? I'm kind of curious about that.
No, that's part of the story we tell, and try and not be so reductionist to the contact sort of myth, in that the Virginia Company had learned in the 16th century with the Lost Colony and other Spanish ventures how they needed to conduct themselves, both with the Spanish, who were a threat, and the indigenous population. And they very specifically talk about that, and often in conjunction. They say, do not settle your fort between wherever you decide in the ocean where the indigenous can be used against you. Mm-hmm. And the implication there is the Spanish enslaving the population and making them fight for them, mm-hmm. and taking out the colony. So it's a very elegant and rich sort of description in the Virginia Company's mind in terms of business. It is a corporate mm-hmm. venture, no doubt.
Okay. Well, we are just about out of time, David. Everybody, please check out some of the links in the show notes, and we'll have the YouTube channel up there as well if you want to learn some more about what's going on over there. And just to wrap up, is there anything that we didn't talk about that you want to mention that will help people understand Jamestown more, or maybe some resources or just anything final that you want to mention about Jamestown?
No, just come visit us. We're out there working, and the story, as it always does with archaeology, will bring on more questions, and mm-hmm. the past will evolve into what it will. And it's a very exciting time for us in terms of the different cultural groups we're looking at, mm-hmm. and we I think we got some exciting stuff to find in the future. Hopefully we'll be there in the future.
Awesome.
See, climate change, sea level rise.
Right.
Being a low lying ground there. So
yeah, yeah. 14 feet is not a lot of leeway.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, David. This has been fascinating, and please come back on the show if you guys make any more, any major discoveries. We'd love to be the first ones to hear about that, but I understand if you got to tell the other media outlets. But yeah, anyway, thanks a lot for coming on the show. This has been great.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArchPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show was produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. The show is edited by Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast, so check it out. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.